This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Jason Griffey. He's the head of Library Information Technology at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga and the creator of LibraryBox. Jason Griffey, welcome to the show.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
The first thing I wanted to talk about was when I was going over your blog and over your presentations and things and listening to the American Libraries Live thing. A lot of what your topics that you discuss is about emerging technologies, new things that are coming out in the next few years. But my first question I wanted to hear is what sort of crazy sci-fi technology that's hundreds of years in the future, Star Trek kind of stuff, that you wish existed? What do you wish you could make just magically happen? And follow up, how would you apply it to libraries?
Oh, man.
So Jetpack, you have to say why Jetpack would apply to libraries.
Sure. Okay. Well, I think that you said, you know, Star Trek technologies. I think the two things that I think everybody wants out of Star Trek is the teleporter and the replicator, right? Like those are the iconic kinds of pieces of technology from that world. And teleporter, because, well, who wouldn't want to just blink your eyes and be somewhere? That would certainly make ILL a lot easier, right? Throw your book in, throw your book on the transport pad, and it just shows up in the library across the city, and
save some shipping costs too.
So. That's right, and well, and of course, you know, with the technology that it goes hands in hand with, the replicator, right? Like anything where I can. The promise of the replicator is the promise of a post-scarcity world, right? When you can have anything, any object, any substance, any foodstuff, any piece of technology, if you can do that by simply talking to a box on the wall, that's pretty amazing stuff. So I think, you know, if I could have that, there'd be a lot more Earl Grey tea in my office. There's already quite a great deal of it, so there'd be even more if I had a replicator here.
Just instantly hot then.
So. That's right. Tea Earl Grey hot. And then, of course, I mean, you know, the ability to dream up new stuff becomes much easier when you don't actually have to build it. You can simply, describe to the computer what you want. But for my own geeky reasons, the answer whenever anyone asks me what kind of future tech do you want is always lightsaber. And the reason is it's a lightsaber.
Of course.
Like, what are you talking about? Why do you need a reason? It's a lightsaber.
I always used to say before the Star Wars prequels came out, I said the first preview that I want to see could just be a lightsaber lighting up and I would be happy.
Oh, yeah. No, right? Like, why would you want anything else?
And then the prequels happened, and I don't know.
Yeah. Problem is, I'm not exactly sure what the library effect of having lightsabers, you know, is. I'm not sure that helps the library world that much. The replicator, a little more direct, and the transporter, a little more direct. Those would be the – if I could wave my wand and have 500-year, you know, technology from 500 years in the future, those are the two that I'd want.
And I guess the lightsaber could be security. I don't know.
That's true. It's fighting off the hordes.
And the funny thing is that replicators don't seem as far in the future now anymore with 3D printing. It's sort of, I mean, we're having to design a lot of this stuff, but I mean, it seems sort of like you put this thing into this box and it comes out. So.
Yeah. It's one of those kind of, there have been examples. There are plenty of examples of science fiction, in not predicting the future as much as driving the development of the technologies that lead to themselves, right? It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. There's lots of examples of where a science fiction author has described something and then scientists have gone, you know, that's a really cool idea. Let's see if we can do that. Sometime in the future. And the 3D printing replicator thing is one of those instances where when Roddenberry first came up with the idea, or it probably predates Roddenberry, but when it was kind of, you know, thrust into the popular consciousness by Roddenberry, that, you know, there may not have been a clear kind of scientific idea about how that might work, but we actually sort of understand how that could happen now. You know, we don't have the tools yet to make it happen, but there is no particular reason on the physical, physics, you know, chemical front that it couldn't happen, which is one of those situations where it's, you know, it with slightly better technology and slightly better energy sources, and, you know, yeah, sure, we could do that.
It's pretty exciting to think about. Sometimes, like, yeah, even with like our cell phones, you know, are now more powerful than Kirk's communicators.
Yeah. Oh yeah. By far. Yeah. 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 It doesn't. There's not a day. There's not a day where I'm not amazed at the fact that I'm carrying a computer in my pocket that's dozens of times more powerful than the one that sent people to the moon. You know, that's just a fact about the world that we take for granted. That's crazy amazing.
And that's one thing I had to ask you about later, but since it kind of came up, was, can you talk a little bit about the Warren Ellis essay that you posted a link to? I hadn't seen it before that, but the one about the we're living in the future kind of thing. What excited you about that?
Sure.
And I'll provide a link in the show notes for that. But.
Okay. I'm actually going to pull it up really quick.
Because I had read his work before, but I hadn't read that particular essay until you tweeted it first.
Was in the science fiction condition, is that right?
How to see the future.
How to see the future, yeah. And he uses the phrase, the science fiction condition. It was just such a great kind of, it was such a great essay that talked about how wonderful the time we are living in is, right? Like we think about, you know, science fiction as this thing that is around the corner. We think about kind of these technologies as things that are around the corner, but it's been 30 years. Has it been that long since William Gibson kind of showed us that the future really is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. That the world we live in is the future. We just don't always see it that way. And that's kind of been my, I don't want to say role, but what I have done over the last few years with writing and presenting and things has all kind of been in that vein, in the, like, the future, you know, here is the nearly emergent future. Here is how it is likely to affect us. Be ready.
Right, you know, just around the corners.
Just around the corner. And these are things, you know, I try not to talk about futures that are too far out, right? Like, once you get past an event horizon of 5, 8, 10 years with technology, things get really weird. One of the biggest kind of projects that I've been working on here at work is here at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga is a new library. We're building a brand new academic library, and we have been in the planning processes for 4 years, a little more than 4 years now, and it's supposed to open in about a year. This new library is, when they came to us, said, you know, the university, the state said, you know, you're building a library that we want to last for 30 years. We want this to be a building that is still useful as a library in 30 years. And I kind of threw my hands up and had some small panic attacks, because there is no way to, you know, there is no way to predict 10 years from now what an appropriate library might look like, especially, I mean, you know, an academic library where the curriculum is going to change significantly and the expectations of the students are going to change significantly. And then when, you know, I'm the head of IT here in the library, and when it came to trying to plan the information infrastructure for the building, I like to think that we've done a good job, but trying to plan the infrastructure technology for a building, I don't know what I'm going to need to support in 5 years. I don't have a clue. Right, so,
because, I mean, 30 years ago, there was no World Wide Web. So that's how different the world is in 30 years.
5 years ago, there was no iPhone. You know, like, 3 years ago, there was no iPad.
Mm-hmm.
So to try and plan information, you know, how people are going to access the information that the library is going to be providing. You know, we're still going to be providing information. We're probably going to be providing digital information at an increasing rate. You know, there's some good bets about the way things are going to go. But as far as what the patron expectation is going to be and how they are going to want to interface with that information, I've made some good bets, and most of them involve being flexible enough to change things, because there is, you know, very, very little that I was sure about. I was very sure we were going to need lots of power, yes. You know, like no shortage of the need for electricity, as high a speed, you know, as high a speed internet as I could possibly pump into the thing. And other than that, we're just, you know, there's living in the science fiction condition is really hard when you're trying to plan 10 years out, much less 30 years out.
Right. Well, one of the things you're kind of doing to move into that science fiction-y future is with your library box project.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about that? How you came to it? I know it's based on the Pirate Box, and can you tell me a little bit about Pirate Box first, so we can get a sort of foundation of what it is and how you came to adapt that for libraries?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So for a while I had been watching, this project that was started by an art professor at New York University named David Dartz, Dr. David Dartz. And he had started as an art project, not as a kind of a tool or a technology project, but, you know, really as an art project, this piece of software based on certain kinds of hardware called Pirate Box. And the idea with Pirate Box is similar to the sorts of there have been other kind of digital art projects like dead drops, USB dead drops, where people just cement USB drives into walls and let people plug into them and leave files or take files off of them. The Pirate Box is a sort of a wireless dead drop. That is, what Dr. Dartz did was develop software that you could apply to a wireless router that would turn the router into this self-sustaining little file sharing infrastructure. So anyone, when you turn the Pirate Box on, anyone could connect to that wireless signal, and using whatever device you're connected with, you could leave a file or take a file or many files. So because the Pirate Box is not connected to the internet in any way, it is its own self-contained wireless signal. So it doesn't talk to internet servers. It doesn't talk to you know, the Google. It doesn't talk to anybody online. Because of that, it's totally off the grid and anonymous. So his Pirate Box project was all about, judging from the name, right? Pirate Box. It was all about the a statement about how digital piracy, in big scare quotes there, piracy in big scare quotes from me, is really unstoppable and is something that, you know, can be totally off the grid, totally anonymous, and driven by very inexpensive hardware. So I had been watching this because I thought it was a really interesting project. I thought it was a really interesting art project. I thought the technology behind it was really kind of cool. And a couple of people that were working with him on the project managed to get the code to a point where it would run on this one particular piece of hardware, the TP-Link MR3020. And that was important, that the original versions of the Pirate Box were big. They fit in big metal lunch boxes and used like lead acid batteries. They needed a lot of power and they needed big pieces of hardware because that was all there really was at the time. This was 2-3 years ago or so, almost 3 years ago at this point. Because of the wonders of technology and Moore's law, you know, technology gets smaller and faster and uses less electricity. So a couple of coders, the main one that I've been working with is a German coder named Matthias Strubel, who's been a big help. He another of the Pirate Box project coders managed to get the Pirate Box code running on the MR3020, and the MR3020 is like a $35 to $40 router that is about the size of a hockey puck. Very, very small, very light, very cheap, right? $40. Mm-hmm. It runs on USB power. It runs on standard kind of 5-volt USB power, which means that you could power it with a battery. A small battery, like you can run it off AA batteries. You don't actually need these big batteries and big pieces of hardware and heavy, you know, lunch boxes. You could actually make a Pirate Box that fit in your pocket. So when I saw that happen, when I saw that kind of turn in the project, I had been thinking about library uses of the project for a while, and the biggest barrier that I could see was that it's very hard to sell libraries and educators. You know, I work in an academic library. But the kind of idea was that in my head, I was trying to think of how could it be useful for education? How could it be useful for libraries? And the biggest barrier that I could see was the whole pirate aspect, right? The ability to upload files. If anyone can randomly upload files to this server, obviously I don't think it takes much imagination to, see how quickly things could go wrong.
exactly.
You can very quickly have material on the server that you did not want, and that could result in both, you know, police activity and the FBI becoming interested. So you know, that as an art project is great. That as a useful tool for libraries was something that I knew needed to change. So. The Pirate Box project is totally open source. All of the code was available. So I just started kind of looking at it and playing with it and digging into the code to see where tinkering, right? Like to see how do I change this? Is it possible for me to easily remove the ability to upload things? Oh, okay. Well, I figured that bit out. Okay. Well, now, like, can I change the interface a little bit? Oh, okay. Well, I can do that too. Well, now if I make it a little easier to install, if I make the install process a little smoother and make it so that other people can build this thing and, you know, load, you know, library materials onto it or, you know, freely available public domain materials onto it, it becomes a really interesting project for libraries. It becomes something where you can provide, you can provide access to digital materials totally off the grid in places where there is no internet access. And, you know, while that is increasingly rare these days, it certainly is not so rare that we all can't think of a place where there isn't in the internet still. So once I kind of tinkered with the code and got it working, I put up a website and I made, you know, my code, all of the changes and everything available, on, a social coding site called GitHub. And I made a little website and I generally announced it at, Computers and Libraries early this year, I guess, was the first kind of public demo of it. I took a library box. I built one and took it with me and put it in my bag and just ran it off a battery while I was walking around the conference at Computers and Libraries 2012. And it was still pretty rough. It was definitely a 1.0, very hard. I would say it was hard to build. The coding process was still pretty pretty technical. And so over the next 6 months or so, I worked pretty hard on and off at trying to make the installation process smoother, at trying to make it a little more obvious what needed to be done, and just clean the code up and make it run a little faster and that sort of stuff. So
when you were at the Computers and Libraries conference, did you get a lot of good buzz about it? I mean, did you get people excited about the project?
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot of good feedback. It was really interesting to see. I get kind of two reactions. There are two kind of first blush reactions to LibraryBox. One is, oh, wow, that's really cool. And the other is, why would I want that? And I think both of those are really illustrative of the project. I think that it's true that it's kind of technologically interesting, and it's also true that it is not something that everyone has an obvious use case for. So, you know, ultimately it boils down to a library box is a small portable router that has the ability to share a Wi-Fi signal that anyone can attach to, that you can download stuff from, right? It's a portable wireless digital distribution device. And you could totally do this with a laptop, right? Like, you can have a public share on a laptop, publicly distribute your Wi-Fi signal. You know, the technology is there for this to happen with other stuff. It's not, the idea isn't particularly novel, I don't think. But the fact that you can have a piece of $40, $35 at this point, $35 hardware, right? So for $35 and a half hour of your time, you can build a digital distribution center for files that will work anywhere you can plug it into anything, including a battery or a solar panel. And, you know,
that's very cool.
Very cool, right? Like, there's some power there that I think is really interesting. And if you'll indulge me in a small story, the thing that, so I was working on the version one and it worked and it was fine. I wasn't really sure what to do next. Like, I was like, okay, that was a cool proof of concept and neat. All right. And then I got an email from a person in China, and they had seen my project. This was an American who was in China teaching English. And I got an email because they had seen the website and had read kind of what I was working on. And the English teacher, the instructor said, you know, this is exactly what I've been looking for. I was like, oh, okay, what do you mean? And he said, well, in where I am, I'm teaching English to lower and middle income people in this small town in China, because English is a major, the ability to speak and read English is a major stepping stone toward higher income brackets. Just that skill alone opens up a huge amount of income mobility to people in where he was. And the lower and the middle income people were having trouble actually being able to access the materials that they needed online because of the Great Firewall. Upper income people simply use a VPN and ignore the firewall completely. They get around it technologically because they can afford to pay for a VPN to get their IP changed. But lower and middle income people couldn't. And he had been looking for a project that allowed him to do basically this, inexpensively share to very small localized groups of people, his class, educational materials that they couldn't get themselves. All of the people in his class, the lower income people included, they all had mobile phones that were capable of, accessing a Wi-Fi signal and downloading digital material and reading it. Mm-hmm. E-gadgets, the actual, hardware to access the material, everyone had. But because of the censorship of the net, they couldn't get what they needed. And he I worked with him to make sure that the code worked on the Chinese variant, the Asian variant of the hardware. Mm-hmm. And he is currently using it and spreading it to the other teachers of English he knows, right, in that area to spread educational materials in a place where that is difficult. And that was my aha moment. That was the moment when the light bulb went off, and I said, that. There is the use case that makes me want to work on this project. Like, that is important. The ability to give people the information they need to make their lives better, right? Like, that's the ultimate dream of a library. Like, that's what a library wants to do, right? A library wants to give people information to improve their lives. And the fact that I knew that even one place was using a library box to do this was just... That was majorly inspiring to me. So
that's a great story.
Yeah. I've kept in touch, and that was really what drove me to the version what we're on now, which is I'm calling version 1.5. It's not quite a 2.0. There's some stuff that I still want to add to it, but making the installation much easier, making very detailed, thorough instructions for building your own. All of that kind of came out of the conversations that I had with this English teacher. And after that, I started kind of looking for other similar use cases. And the real strength, I think, of Library Box, the promise, I guess, and it doesn't, again, the idea is, I don't particularly original, even the instantiation is not, the product itself is interesting, and it's my project, so I get to be obsessive about it. But the fact is that these little easily shareable bits of digital information don't get more difficult to share over the next several years. It just gets, this hardware gets cheaper, the battery power gets easier to provide, it gets easier and easier to do this. And the idea of taking a library box and plugging it into a solar panel and throwing, a bunch of them across villages in South America or Africa or places where they may have cell phones but no direct data connection. That sort of thing is really exciting to me.
As Jessamyn West always likes to say too, that the digital divide even is real in America too. It doesn't seem like it in some places, but it is.
Absolutely is. I mean, I grew up in rural Kentucky, and I currently live in rural Tennessee. So the digital divide is alive and well in my mind. The ability to take this to places that that don't have the ability to just hop on and download an ebook, right, is really interesting. and I think potentially powerful, especially, again, it's the combination of how inexpensive it is and how easy can I make it to do, right? The easier it is and the cheaper it is, the more ubiquitous it can be, and theoretically, the more places it can go.
Right.
So that's kind of what I'm concentrating on, is trying to get the project as inexpensive as possible, as easy to install as possible, and try to see where that takes it.
So do you have any other concrete plans for the future of how to expand what you're doing besides just simplifying the process?
Yeah. I mean, I have kind of a rough development path that I want to take. The website, I should mention the website. I'm sure you'll put it in the show notes, but the website is librarybox.us. So just the way it sounds, librarybox.us. And on the website, I've got some use cases and then a future roadmap section where I've got a little bit of an outline of how, you know, kind of things that I'd like for it to do in the future. Some of the things that I want it to do are currently beyond my meager coding skills. So as a result, one of the things that I'd like to concentrate on in the next year, 6 months to a year, now that I've got kind of a stable version and I've got clear instructions and I've got some decent text up on the side about kind of what it's for, I'd like to concentrate on trying to find some grant funding, frankly. I mean, I'm at an academic university. I'm an academic librarian. That's kind of the way things go in academia, right?
Right.
You find grant funding for it. So I'd like to find some grant funding, mainly to be able to trade money for skills I don't have.
Bring on the experts.
Right. Yeah. Right. Like I would love to be able to hand someone some money and say, okay, this is the thing I need it to do because I don't have the skill to make it do it yet. And I don't currently have the time to, I mean, I would rather not wait on the time it would take me to level up to that point. So, I very much would like to find some funding that would allow me to accelerate the process to make it, an even better project. I mean, the project is totally open source. Like I said, it's all available. It's all out there. There's no kind of hidden proprietary motive here. I just want this thing to be, as ubiquitous as we can make it, as long as there's, you know, holes in the world that don't have access to digital information.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very cool project. So I wish you luck and success with it. So.
Thanks. I hope so. I mean, there's interesting developments. There's other people working on variants of it. I know that there's a couple of programmers that have taken the idea and are trying to, you know, twist it in different ways, make it more friendly to ebooks, make it more friendly to certain kinds of materials. And that's exciting. That's really, really exciting. I hope that ultimately, you know, any development that anybody else is working on, I hope ultimately gets rolled back into the main branch of LibraryBox. I want it to be as good as it can be for as many people as it can help. So,
well, it's like I said, it's very cool. So I was very excited about it when I first read about it, and you were instantly on the list of must talk to Jason for podcasts. So.
Thanks a lot. It's a lot.
So another project that you're involved in that's also cool is the American Libraries Live that just debuted its first episode last week. How did that come about? Is that something that was your idea, or did somebody, did ALA or somebody come to you about that?
Yeah, it's a combination of those things. I've been working with a couple of editors at ALA TechSource for a few years now. I've written a couple of library technology reports, and I've contributed to a couple of other technology reports. And I've been working with a couple of editors there, and maybe a year and a half ago or so, we had talked about the bridging beyond text, right? Like doing a podcast or doing some a video cast, doing some form of media that wasn't kind of text based. And you know, after talking and stuff, we decided that it would be really interesting to do something that was way more interactive than the traditional talking head kind of webinar sort of thing that happens. Those are great. I've done dozens of them. They're really, really useful if you're kind of in an instructor mode. But if what you want is a little more free form discussion, they don't always map well to that. So a bunch of us talked and we kind of hit on this idea of a live talk show sort of interactive show. And this was maybe 18 months ago, a year ago. And at the time, it wasn't totally obvious how to make that happen technologically. we looked at a bunch of options, like, using Skype video and pushing it all to a single machine and then using something like Livestream to then redistribute that. And we played with a bunch of different kind of how to make this work. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until Google Hangouts kind of went public with their with Hangouts Live, with the ability to really kind of push that out live, where we were like, okay, so this is the tool, this is the right way this should be done. And we played with it, we did some initial tests, and it just works really well for what we wanted. So that's kind of how it came about. We're going to be doing one a month. I'm not going to be the host every month. It's going to rotate between several very, very interesting people. Although I hope to do several over the course of the next year. I'm hoping I get slotted in that guest spot, the host spots over time. But I was really, really pleased doing the first one. It's doing it live, streaming it live, and then the ability to have kind of live interactions with people, I think, is really the selling point. I think that's what makes it a cool new product, a cool new kind of way to get information. The first episode clocked in at, it was 1,800 or so people tuned in, which was phenomenal. Blew my mind. I was incredibly, incredibly flattered that that we had that kind of audience. So I'm really excited about where it could go. I think there's just a lot of options there.
And did I read that you all hit like a wall on the chat of how many people could be in there or something? Is there a limit to how many people can be in the chat?
Well, yeah, the tool that we kind of hacked it together, right? It was a project where they built a page and we had the embed, the Google embed that people could then watch. And then we also wanted the ability to have that kind of back channel chat stuff happening. And the tool that we chose for that, I think it was a 250 or 300 person simultaneous limit, and obviously that filled up real quick. So we underestimated the need there. So next time around, I think we'll be using something slightly different that has a little higher cap.
It was a good problem to have.
That's right, right? Like if you're going to fail big.
We're too popular.
That's right. That's right. It's exactly the right problems. So hopefully we'll find a better tool for that next time around.
Well, and another library project that I think you were involved in starting is the Library Boing Boing group through ALA.
Yeah, through ALA, the members interest group.
Right.
Through ALA.
Can you talk about what that is and how you got started with that?
Sure. There are couple of people at ALA that really kind of spearheaded that endeavor. Jenny Levine and Christina Coleman, her both ALA staffers, had been kind of working on the back, formally on the ALA side, to try to find relationships with interesting groups that ALA could, bridge with. And several of those are names that anybody that's kind of in the tech world would recognize, right? Boing Boing, mm-hmm. Magazine, so these kind of progressive technologists trying to figure out how we could get them interested in the ALA, interested in libraries, and how we could help them, reach out in different ways. So it's another project where Jenny and I had been talking about it for a long time about how could we kind of get libraries into those spaces and make librarians more aware of them and that sort of thing. And we finally, Jenny and Christina were able to talk with the Boing Boing group, which is a who's who of, internet famous peoples. Jenny Jardin and Cory Doctorow and Mark Fraunfelder and that whole Boing Boing group. And
the people that make geeks go squee.
They definitely all those names make geeks go squee. And they're all huge library fans, right? They're all huge reading fans. They're all literary people, and they love what libraries do. And when we approached them and said, could we maybe work with you guys to get more information out about libraries, seeing as how you're the biggest blog on the entire internet? They were incredibly gracious and agreed to let us start this group, Library Boing Boing, through the ALA, using the Boing Boing name internally. Agreed to give us the ability to work with them to get some stories, like important library stories, up on Boing Boing directly, so that we have the ability to get libraries in front of literally millions of people a month. Boing Boing, as I said, is the most popular blog on the whole internet, right? And does get millions and millions and millions of people looking at it. So the ability to get those library stories up is just huge. We're also working with them to do the next step is kind of Boing Boing meetups. We're going to be doing some kind of in-person meetup-y stuff around the country, and having kits, kind of a meetup kit that libraries can use to do these little in-person informal meetups with Boing Boing fans. We're working with Make Magazine. You may have seen there's going to be some interesting stuff at ALA Midwinter and ALA Annual with them. Going to be some cool stuff happening there. So it's a really great group. It's a members interest group of the ALA. Anybody that is interested, please, join up. We're going to have a meetup at Midwinter. We're going to have both a business meeting, although business is again in scare quotes there, because we tend to do instead of talk as often as we can. So it's not quite a meeting as much as it is a series of roughly planned strategic strategic strikes. It's like, let's do these things, we're going to be doing programs. I think it's a really interesting way of getting the technorati of the internet a little more interested in what libraries can offer them. Right. And I think it's a cool outlet for that.
Well, you mentioned on your blog a while back that you, I think you were specifically writing about something that Meredith Farkas had posted, but you said that you really admired her and people like Jessamyn West and Michael Stevens, et cetera. And the reason that you really admired them is because they sort of grokked librarianship in a way that you can only dream of sort of getting the whole concept. Can you talk about what it is that you admire about people like that or any other librarians, that not them specifically maybe, but
oh yeah.
What you admire about the people you admire in the field?
Totally. I can wax rhapsodic about lots of librarians. I love librarians. And I mean, there really are some that are just, that have inspired me in so many ways. I mean, there's everything from, I mentioned in the blog post, I mentioned Meredith, who, has just been a force for interesting ways of looking at, public services and instruction and how to kind of move those into the digital world. And, she was one of the early librarians working on the use of wikis and on how to kind of bridge the gap in the web 2.0 era of librarianship, how to really kind of get that in front of people. She was, outspoken in a time where it was, there were still, and I guess still maybe probably are, lots of people who were very doubtful of the strength of these tools. I admire people who are willing to, stand up and put themselves, what is the old saying, right? The first person is the martyr and the second person is the conqueror.
Right.
It's not easy for people to be willing to put themselves out there in that martyr position. And the people that I really admire are the people who do that. And there's no shortage of those people in the library world, which is fantastic. Meredith, Michael Stevens, Jenny Levine, who I mentioned earlier, Jenica Rogers, who is an incredibly bright, brilliant leader in libraries, and is through her publicness, the very fact that she is willing and able to be as public as she is about her process in leading her library is, I think, a model that everyone should be watching. There's so many others. Andromeda Yelton, who is this amazing librarian who's currently working on the Unglue It project, but behind the scenes is working on inclusiveness in libraries and bringing the level of coding and technology skills in libraries up through the LIDA interest group that she started, the LIDA Code Year interest group. There's so many people that are trying in their own way to push the profession and to push our services forward. And those are the people that really, really inspires me. Those are the people I want to hang around and have a beer with,
Those are the people at the ALA parties that you want to go to after the after parties.
Those are the people that I want to go hang out with because they're, I have been accused, and not unjustly, of being, far too focused on the future. And that really is, again, that's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in the future, in where our profession, where our role, where are our libraries, where information, I'm interested in where all of that goes. The people that make that happen, I think are the interesting people, right? Those are the ones where, I think there's a lot of learning to be done from them. There's a great quote. I write a blog. I write several blogs, but one of the blogs that I write is really future techie, called Release Candidate. It's on my website. But the byline of it is a quote from Thomas Jefferson that says, "I like the dreams of the future better than the history of the past." And that Great. Really is what I'm interested in. The dreams of the future. That's what I want to work towards.
Well, so. I hope you it help keep pushing the profession into the future. As we said in that Warren Ellis thing, we're kind of living in the future now, and part of that is that we're making the future.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
So, Jason, thanks so much for talking to me for the show. I think we had a great conversation. I hope a lot of people learn things and can go check out Library Box and American Libraries Live and everything else that's going on.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
Can you tell people how to find you online?
Absolutely. I am eminently Googleable, so if you don't remember anything else, remember my name, Jason Griffey. You'll find pretty much everything there. My website is jasongriffey.net, and on there is linked all my social media places. I'm active on Twitter. I have a couple of blogs that I write, both kind of a personal blog, personal, professional. I write for ALA Tech Source on their blog. And I've published a couple of books, so you can find all that out at my website. But jasongriffey.net will get you directly to the website if you don't want to bother with the Google.
All right. Well, Jason, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
Hey, bye.
Bye.
If you'd like to learn more about the podcast, you can visit circulatingideas.com. Or you can follow the show on Twitter at circideas or on Tumblr at circulatingideas.tumblr.com. You can also like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas. And if you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can contact the show at circulatingideas.mail@gmail.com. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me again next time.